Are you, darling? Will you go sing a song? I want to hear it.
Come on. Okay. Oh. Okay. So they're going to join us.
You've got to practice. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to the concert.
Right.
What?
Good.
Okay. What, darling? Talk to me. Really? What's the Super Bowl? What's the Super Bowl? What's the Super Bowl?
It's a football
place. Is it? You're voting for the Seahawks. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
What's the plan?
So they're going to help us say some prayers.
Okay, go on.
Okay. So
where's Sarah? Is she going to sing too?
Sarah's going to sing too.
Sing on notes. Get over there.
So we're going to do Chakimuni's Buddha mantra three times.
Sing loud.
Tayata. Four immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness.
May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering.
May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness and happiness free from suffering.
May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies.
Turn it on, Sarah. Mantra.
So have compassion and love in our hearts as we say this one, the Buddha of compassion.
Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Okay. And seven green tara mantras.
And this one is for action, success, courage, to cut through the obstacles, to make things happen. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.
So now the children can go practice and get ready, and we'll see you at 11:30. Okay? Right. Yeah, you're going to come back and do your presentation to Venerable Rabina, okay?
We're just coming in from the back. We've got plenty of room up here. So please don't be shy. Come on up.
Are there more chairs for people? No chairs there?
We should have the bench here that can sit on.
Okay. Yeah. Grab some more. We don't need more chairs though? We can bring more chairs in or not? Can we ask somebody? Okay. Take the jackets off, Sarah. Look, they're on the jacket. Take the jacket off. Sarah, take the jackets off. Off the seat, sweetheart. Oh, I see. Oh, I see. It's Deanne's.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Oh, good. Okay, people. Hi there. Well, there's a lot of people that always see that the benches at the back are lower down than the front people. I always wish you could elevate your seat so I can see you all. I can't see you, you know. It's a trouble. Never mind. So what is it? The benches? And what's behind the benches? Is it chairs? Are you guys at the back on chairs or benches? Benches. I see. Okay. Never mind. Okay. Okay. Well, the last a couple of days ago, we were talking about the development of a good. Yesterday, actually, it was called developing a good heart. And that sort of sounds like I say, you know, it sounds really nice. Oh yeah, good heart sounds like a nice person, a good heart. When we start to unpack it, it's actually unbelievably difficult. Unbelievably difficult practice. It sounds like an easy practice, but it really is. When you hear teachings about emptiness, when there's all this fancy philosophy, it sounds like that's difficult. All right, I tell you, developing a good heart, it was like, you know, and the reason it's difficult, it's not difficult, okay, the reason it's difficult is because we have friends, we have enemies, and we have strangers in the world. This is the way we divide the world, let's face it. There's no fourth category. And this, for the Buddhist view, is they're the objects of attachment, aversion, or anger, and then the other one is indifference. So we know there are some people we're attracted to, we're attached to, and they appear really nice to us. Whether they're our children, whether it's our beloved partner, whether it's whatever it might be. The people we are attached to, they look nice, they seem nice, we go towards them. They make us happy, we feel happy thinking about them. So to them, a good heart, a kind heart is falling off a log easy. No effort at all. You want to have a good heart. You feel already the good heart. It's easy to be kind to them. It's easy to have compassion for them. And that's just a tiny percentage of all those on earth. And we think, oh, that's normal. That's normal life. You know, you love your friends, don't you? You have a good heart towards them. But then it gets difficult, and it just becomes outrageous if we start to think about the ones we don't like. We think, well, why on earth would I have a good heart towards them? Don't be ridiculous. Because they're mean to me, they're harmful to me, he gave me up for someone else, they abuse me. There are many people on this earth who are horrible, there's no doubt about that. People harm each other terribly. And then we can't even imagine a logical reason to have a good heart towards them. That sounds ridiculous. But then there's a third category, which is the vast majority of all sentient beings. Let's face it, 99.999% of all other sentient beings fall into this third category, and they're called strangers. And who is a stranger? If a friend is one who does what my attachment wants, and an enemy is one who doesn't do what my attachment wants, if attachment is what we have for those who do what I want and aversion to those who don't, then what is the feeling we have towards the others? We have indifference to them. We couldn't care less. Because why? Because they've neither harmed nor helped me. So that's the world. That's the world, and we all think it's normal. So we know it's good to have a good heart, and it sounds nice, but the real point of the good heart is to get it, is to develop it where it's difficult. Where it's difficult. And that's, of course, for the people who've harmed us, which seems complete contradiction in our world. It seems insane. And it seems impossible, if we even think of trying to do it, it seems impossible, to actually have a good heart. So what's a good heart consist of? Well, using the Buddhist psychological way of saying it, it's not complicated. A good heart means love and compassion. These are the two essential good qualities, the way Buddhist psychology talks, and I'll give the definitions. You'll see what I'm saying. Love and compassion. Love and compassion. Love is, the thought is, may they be happy. You delight in someone's happiness. And we definitely have that for our friends, for our beloveds. Then you have a compassion, which is another aspect. You see them suffering and you empathize with their suffering and you want them not to suffer. That's compassion. And these are the essence of a good heart, basically. So in a way we can say we can have it sometimes for strangers. You read news about some poor people and you have compassion. But it doesn't last long, because once you stop reading the story, they're out of your mind again, isn't it? Or if you hear about a stranger dying, maybe, it can be sad for a moment. You might have a good heart. But the one that we can see is the really tough one, which is in our face every day. This is the one for the enemies, for the mean people, for the ugly one. And unfortunately, that can be our best friend at the same time. One morning, you love them. Next morning, next day in the afternoon, you want to kill them. So even though it sounds easier to have a good heart. So the key to this then is what? You know, the key to this even is what? Is the first step, junior school, high school, of practice, is being aware of your own mind. Noticing your own mind, you know. And this is the hardest one. It's easy when, you know, even if you're just in the restaurant and you like chocolate cake and you order chocolate cake and she comes and smiles at you and then she gives you an extra big piece, an extra cream and gives you a discount. Guaranteed you have a very good heart towards her. It'll be easy to love her, to say, I want her to be happy. Isn't she kind? It's so easy to have this. So it's not much virtue practice. You know, not much merit. The way the Buddhists talk, they talk about creating merit, which sounds kind of rather holy. And then they talk about purifying. So really that's just a simple way of talking about that is you've got to grow the flowers and you've got to pull out the weeds. So every time you have a positive thought, that's, quotes, creating merit. Every time you do a good action, that's called creating merit. This is the whole idea of karma, where you try to program your mind with goodness and deprogram your mind with the badness. It's a very simple way of saying what practice is, you know? There's a chair here, Peter. No, two chairs. Three chairs. So this demands awareness of our mind. It's easy enough to say it. And sort of if you want, and so practice, when we look at the word practice, we think of tennis practice, we think of piano practice, you know that what it means is you've got to learn the theory and then you've got to keep doing it until you get good at it. That's what we know is practice. And we all know practice makes perfect. Well, it's the same here. So if you're in the restaurant and you get what your attachment wants, the chocolate cake and the bonus of extra cream and a discount, then you're going to feel good. You're going to have a good heart. But mostly, unfortunately, that's called attachment, which triggers a very nice feeling. And she will look very nice to you. What a sweet girl. You remember this nice waitress. But there's no merit there at all. Because she just gave you what you wanted. It's easy. It's easy to love your divine baby. Your baby that's so innocent and beautiful, except when it, you know, cuckoos in its thing. Then you get a bit upset, maybe. But even that's delicious for a beautiful new baby. Even its dirty diapers is not so bad. Because we have such attachment to this beautiful thing, they appear totally divine. We're thinking of them day and night. So that's attachment that informs our kindness. Attachment informs our love there. And so you can say in terms of practicing love, there's not much merit there. It's easy. It's falling off. It's like going downhill instead of uphill. So the point is, in order to practice something, you know it's logical. Let's say you've got to do your push-ups and you want to get strong. When you do your push-ups, and the moment it starts to get difficult, the moment you feel the pain, and then you stop,
and you say, oh, I did my push-ups today. Well, actually, you didn't. Because we all know nothing begins to change. The muscles won't start to change until it hurts. Because that's a sign that you're pushing against the status quo, and that's when you'll begin to get muscle tone. If you only do the push-ups and only do the weights that don't stretch you, you will never, ever, ever change the character of your muscles. Now, we know that. If you only, you know, practice jogging until it hurts, you'll never actually increase. If you only practice the piano to the point where you don't have to push yourself, you'll never learn piano. So making effort, which sounds kind of really heavy, is the only way to make progress. We know this. We know this when it comes to learning anything. And then when it comes to developing your mind, developing love and compassion, giving up attachment, giving up anger, giving up jealousy, stopping harming others, all this is the stuff of this kind of practice, so-called spiritual practice. Well, obviously, you only make progress when you make effort. So it's easy to love your baby. It's easy to love the nice girl in the cafe who gives you an extra discount. But it is not easy if the same girl brings you chocolate cake that's horrible and stale and it's expensive. You won't think she's kind and you won't have a good heart. Well, that's the time to practice a good heart, isn't it? Because she made effort. She did her best, but the poor old cook made a lousy cake. It's not her fault. So then to thank her for her kindness. Now, that is when you leave a better imprint in your mind than before when attachment was all feeling all cute. This is what practice is, and it's tough. So practicing, real practice, is when it's difficult. It's not meant to be sort of masochistic. It's just logical. It's true. Until you push yourself beyond your own comfort zone, you can't say it's practice. And this is logical. So we've got to give ourselves a break. You don't have to suffer all day. You know, you've got to know what your limit is. You don't keep doing push-ups until you collapse from exhaustion. You be reasonable. But you know that you will get better if you do a little bit extra every day, if you push yourself slightly every day. This is easy, Paul. Sit down. And that means, of course, that means learning to love your enemy. Sorry. Can't escape it. And that means forget enemies outside, like your ex-husband. How about your present husband? You know, learn to be kind when he doesn't do the right thing, when he doesn't come home on time, when she is mean to you, when the child doesn't do what you want. This, I mean, we can all see in our ordinary life. Forget, there's no fancy high thing that we're talking about here. It's not even a fancy thing you're supposed to do in your meditation. It's in ordinary daily life, in your face, on the road when the car doesn't do what you want. You know, at work when someone's mean, your child, your next door neighbour, your grandma. Ordinary life. I mean, this is ordinary life. This is real spiritual practice. This is the ground, the field in which we do spiritual practice, you know. And that's the sign of success. When you can one time not say that bad word, one time in your mind, you know, not get annoyed when someone does what you don't like. Because we can see the smallest things can upset us because we're all so fragile, you know. This is what practice is. And then you rejoice the fact that you were able to do that, you know. Forget about sitting there meditating on your breath for 1 hour every day. That sounds great. But it's much harder practice to be kind to the person who's mean to you. Even you don't have contact with them, but in your mind, when you consciously have a thought, may they be happy. That's pretty intense. That's called love. That's what love is. When we say the word love in our culture, it's actually meaning mostly when there's attachment there, when there's a very gooey feeling, you know. But that's not love. That's called attachment. And love and attachment together give this very particular mix, you know, of you see your beautiful baby, you see your divine boyfriend, there's a big, wonderful feeling, and you want them to be happy. But it's very hard for us to distinguish between the attachment component and the love component. And that's what we absolutely have to learn to do. So that's why practice then is when, and you can't do this until you've got some control over your body and speech. This is sort of junior school level of practice. And, you know, to begin to work on your mind is like high school level. To actually practice love and compassion, that's really taught in the Bodhisattva path, which is like university level. The first level, junior school, ground, starting, which sounds so boring, is try and control the body and the speech. And for most of us, that means the speech. We mightn't go around raping too many people, killing too many people, being a terrorist for too many people. We might not do that. Most of us in this room probably don't do too much of that. But look at our speech. We're really good at that one. And in Buddha's little checklist of 10 don'ts, not that many things he requests that we do to be a nice person. I mean, if you had to write down all the don'ts just to drive a car, you'd have a book full. We memorize them all very nicely. This is only 10 things. And the first three are about your body. The first four, the next four are about your speech. And these are Buddha's his first level of instructions, if we want to be follow what Buddha suggests we do. But the big difference here, remember, keep remembering this, is a very important point. When I was a Catholic, that meant I had devotion in God, and then I obeyed God's instructions. That was what was called being good. And then when I sinned, it was when I did what God said not to do. That's what defines a sin. But it's very different here. The action is the same. You know, don't kill, for example. Don't lie. Don't cheat on your partner. Sounds similar. But the reason you don't do it from the Buddhist perspective isn't because Buddha says. It's because he says it'll harm you. It's advice, like a doctor. Don't smoke, Ravina. You might get cancer. So we know very well you don't go home and then think, oh, well, the doctor can't see me, so I will smoke, but I won't get cancer because she doesn't see me. I mean, that's like a complete joke. We know that. Well, this is the approach to morality in Buddhism. It's quite a different approach. We've got to it takes time to get used to this, to become our own boss, in other words. Because I don't want cancer, I will decide to stop smoking. My doctor's advised it, but they're merely a messenger. You don't smoke, you don't not smoke because your doctor says you shouldn't. That's silly. The doctor's a messenger who, from their own experience, can advise you that cancer could be a consequence of smoking, so suggests for your sake you don't do it. This is precisely the way to hear Buddhist instructions, actually. He's not a creator. There's no concept of creator in Buddhism. Therefore, the view of morality is not this one of don't do it because I said. Well, that's the same view of morality we have in the household. Mummy says don't do it, and then you're naughty if you do it. But it's not the same here. And it's very important to understand this one. And when we can get this one, we can really grow up and become accountable, you know, become our own boss, our own judge. So Buddha's suggestion is, just like, you know, Jesus Christ, don't kill, don't this, don't that. But the reason is because he says, first of all, you define what a negative action is. And this is, again, a very interesting point. A negative action, as far as Christianity is concerned, is what God said is negative. And I'm not complaining about that. If that's the view you have, that God's the boss in the universe, then it's right, it's correct. You do God's will. That's really reasonable. But not in the Buddhist one. Buddha was a regular guy, like you and me, who became a Buddha, an enlightened being, the term they use, Sanskrit word, you know. So he's like a doctor. He has found from his own observation his view of what a negative action is, you know, or sin, the way the Christians talk. It is an action not that's wrong because he says so. It's wrong because other people don't like it. It hurts them. So the definition of a negative action in Buddhism is an action that harms another. So we can think of a thousand of those, but we can narrow it down, and he does in this little list of 10 things not to do, the very first level of instructions in Buddhist practice. And those things are, like I said, free of the body, you don't kill any sentient being, you don't take things that haven't been given to you, that's called stealing, and you don't misuse people with your sexual energy. You know, that would mean, in a simple sense, don't cheat on a partner. If you've got a monogamous relationship, you've vowed to be with a certain person, you don't cheat on that person, and you don't take someone else's partner. That's called sexual misconduct, the simple way of it. Obviously, more radical one is raping people, misusing, you know, running around, whatever. You understand? So you're learning to not use your body to harm sentient beings. And the reason Buddha says those things are negative isn't because he says so. This is a really crucial point. He says they're conventional realities that you can prove quite easily. If we did a bit of research in this room, did a market research, we would all have 100% agreement. We don't like being cheated on. We don't like being stolen from. And we certainly don't like being killed. It's very clear, isn't it? So the Buddha says that proves, that's how you prove what a negative action is. It's a conventional agreement among people. We all can see this is true. And that's how he defines a negative action. Not because he says so. And it's a very different view. It's negative, it's a natural negativity. It harms others. So now, the other point is, this is a really crucial point to get. Why then would Buddha say not to do it? Well, the usual answer would be, well, we've just agreed that it's a negative action. That's why I don't do it, because it harms others. But that's too advanced. He wants us to see first that by me killing somebody, by me stealing, I harm myself. So the very first level of practice, and this is the meaning of karma in Buddhism, that Buddha's basic fundamental point, which really is his explanation of the entire universe, when you go into more depth and study it in the Buddhist literature, is that every single sentient being, every second, is thinking and doing and saying something. Look at our own, look at our lives. You're using your mind to think something, then your body and your speech, which are like the servants of your mind, they carry out the wishes of your thoughts, don't they? Very simple. This is just the way, this is the meaning of karma. Even the thought, I sit here in this chair, right, then I decide, I have an intention, and it's called, I will walk out the door. That's an intention. That's the meaning of karma, actually. Then what'll happen? Don't be surprised, I'll pick myself up and walk out the door. Not my legs don't do it. My legs just carry out my thoughts, wishes, don't they? If I'm sitting here thinking, I'm going to sit here and relax, I'd be very surprised if my legs pick me up, wouldn't I? I mean, they'd be completely schizophrenic. You get my point here? So it's sort of obvious the mind is the boss, but we don't really follow this through very powerfully. But this is the fundamental point the Buddha's making. This is the natural law that runs the universe. Intention is the actual word, really, it's the best translation for the meaning of the word karma. That every millisecond we're having intentions, Buddha says. And we come programmed with billions of these from the first second of conception, from having done them before. And that's why so much of the stuff we do is automatic, is spontaneous, is instinctive, you know? So then, we can see then, the intention to kill, I will kill the mouse. This is the thought. But that's not the entire thing that makes it negative now. This is what we've got to really unpack. On the one side, we realize, yes, we agree that killing is negative because sentient beings don't like it. And that includes the mouse. So then we have to look into my mind when I do the action in order to investigate what it is that's going on in there in order to see why it harms me. There's no logic to that unless we unpack it. So what is it? Well, the Buddhist view is very clear. If I look into my mind, then what's going on when I say, I'll kill the mouse? The thought is, I will kill the mouse. That's intention. But we've got to unpack intention and look beneath it. And you might go, well, you got to, what's the reason, Rabina? Why are you killing the mouse? We'd say that. What's your reason? The Buddhists would call it, what's your motivation? Well, I'll go, well, let me think about it now. Well, it's obvious because mouse are creeps, aren't they? They're going to dirty my house. So what's that called? That's called aversion. Like we said before, we have friends who are objects of attachment. That's the first delusion. The second one, in terms of sentient beings, we've got enemies, and here the mouse will fit into this category. They're the objects of my aversion. Disgusting mice. That's called aversion, people. If it was attachment, you'd go, oh, what a pretty mouse. And you try and avoid suffering, harming us. If it was your pet poodle or something, or your pet mouse. That's attachment. But here, in this case, it's aversion in my mind. Ooh, yuck, mice. That's called aversion, which is the basic state of mind beneath anger. You might say you've got anger towards the mouse. You'd have people who kill each other out of violence. They've got anger, for sure. That's anger. Extreme example of aversion. Here, it's just a mouse. There's aversion. Yuck, you know? It's called aversion. The only other option is called indifference. Ignorance. There's attachment, aversion, ignorance. These are the three main delusions, as Buddhist psychology refers to them. And so, in terms of people, like I said, friends are the object of attachment. Enemies are the object of aversion, and strangers are the object of one aspect of this ignorance called indifference. Couldn't care less. So here, and Buddha's saying, what motivates most of our actions instinctively in terms of the negative states is either attachment, aversion, or ignorance. So in this case, it's aversion. Therefore, the thought is, and that's our culture, I will kill the mouse. And because, of course, we learn that mice don't have souls. I was taught as a Catholic that my creatures, animals, don't have souls, but God made them for our benefit. That's the Christian teaching. It's not the Buddhist one, but I'm just telling you. So that's our culture very strongly, you know. I don't know what the teaching is among the Jews, probably similar, and maybe the Muslims, I'm not sure. So that's why it's okay to kill mice and fish and all those things as far as other religions are concerned, and indeed the materialist world, because they don't have brains, you know. Or I don't have big brains, whatever the reason is. So here the Buddhist view is it's a sentient being, mouse, and being a sentient being, it doesn't want to suffer. That's pretty provable. Just like a human. If mice could talk, they could tell you they don't like being killed, they don't like being stomped on. You know, they have fear too. So the Buddha says it's a sentient being who doesn't like being harmed, so therefore killing a mouse would be called a negative action because a mouse doesn't like it. But the reason I harm myself, which is the point here, when I kill a mouse, isn't because it harms the mouse. Is it because my motivation, my reason, what's going on in my mind? So aversion, in other words, becomes the motivating force within me that then causes my foot or my hand to fulfill my wishes of my mind to kill the mouse. So what's going on here, the part of this action, there's the intention, there's the mouse has to be there, you do the action and the mouse dies, that's a complete action of killing. There's four points there. Then we look at the intention, we unpack it, and we see the motivation behind the intention is aversion, anger, which means the wish to harm the mouse. Very simple. Don't want to harm the mouse, I want to kill the wretched thing. Not just harm it, kill it. Well, that sounds pretty intense, doesn't it? And that, Buddha says, is what harms me. Because every second of what we think in our mind, that leaves an imprint, an impression. Every millisecond, we are producing ourself by what our mind is doing. Not just the body. You can have a mouse there and not even see it. And you kill it without even knowing. Your body killed the mouse, but your mind didn't. Your mind had no intention, therefore there was no motivation. You're sitting there thinking about feeding your children. There's no thought of mouse or harming or anything. So therefore you could say literally you did not create any karma. Because there's no intention, there's no motivation. It's very logical. But we don't think of it this way. We think of it, the actions as external, you know. So the reason, again, in the beginning, the first level of practice is control your body and speech. Don't kill, don't lie, don't steal. Don't do actions that we can decide are negative because they harm others. But the reason behind, the motivating thought behind my wish not to kill isn't because Buddha says, isn't yet because it harms others. That's later on. We can also have that. The first thing we have to get is because it will harm me. And this is a really powerful one. Just like not smoking for your own sake, not eating the wrong food for your own sake. That we get in our life. We're really accountable when it comes to consequences in terms of our body. But we don't have any sense of accountability when it comes to what we, you know, the thoughts. We think as long as no one sees me, it can't have a result. This one is therefore quite powerful. This is a view of karma, basically. And the first level of it is brings a lot of thinking. We've got to become accountable. We've got to grow up and realize that I am the boss. This is what Buddha's saying. Buddha's not the boss. He's like a messenger. He's like a doctor advising us. He's not a creator. He is not a punisher. He is not a rewarder. There's no concept like that in Buddhism. We are our own punisher. We are our own rewarder. Our own actions bring their own results. It's a very subtle point, very interesting point, very organic, very reasonable. We've got to really think about it. When we begin with this one, this is the first level of practice, then we become so accountable, so grown up. You know, we become our own boss, which is what we must become. Because what I think, what I do, and I say brings consequences to me. So therefore, I have to know my own mind. I have to control my body and my speech. It's up to me. It doesn't matter what other people think. This is quite intense. And our trouble is, because we're so addicted to what other people think, we're desperate to be seen as a good person, and we're desperate to hide our bad qualities, because we can't bear to be seen as a bad person. And this is a dualistic way we think about morality. We're desperate for other people to see me as nice. That we think that's what makes me nice. And we're desperate for people to not see my bad ones, which is why we keep them all hidden. It's really childish, actually. But it's in all of us. This is the nature of ego, you know. It's very intense, this. So to really have accountability is internal. Guilt, the one we have now, is not accountable. It's like a child. You know, I'm a bad person. It's just internalized anger. Just like, oh, she did this and this and she's a bad person. I did this and this and I'm a bad person. It's useless. It's completely a useless state of mind. It has no benefit whatsoever. It just makes you more miserable. But accountability, I did do this and did do that. But now what can I do to change it? That's accountability. And that's growing up. That's abiding by the laws of karma. That's how a Buddhist would put it, you know. That's what it means. So the first level is don't harm others. The next one is that calms you down enough to be able to begin to look at your mind, which is the real job. Start to change your mind, you know, your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions. Become very familiar with those. But you can't do this if you've got berserk behavior. It's very obvious. You know, you've got some kid who's shouting and screaming and yelling and told them to sit down and watch their mind for 5 minutes. That'd be ridiculous. It's impossible. They've got to control their behavior first. Well, that goes with all of us. And that's why it's, you know, it seems so simple, but it's really profound. If you make a decision, just every day, you know, just a speech. I will never say one bad word about any human being behind their back. This is one of our most most practiced negative actions for most humans, even those of us who think we're such good people. We love to badmouth people. We think it's a virtue to badmouth the politicians, practically. You know? We're always, we can't wait for the person to leave so we can badmouth them. It's such an impulse in us. We have to share our thoughts with someone else, you know? We're not even content to think it ourselves. We have to tell someone else. He did this and she did that at work, and he this and mother this and the father that, and the drunken brother did this. Our husband said this. We just have no control over our speech. And what do you think it's doing to you? Just right there. Forget the disharmony that causes. I mean, look at the divisions in families, you know. Just because people badmouth behind each other's backs and take sides. It's just unbearable. The suffering that comes from it. But look right there at the harm you're doing to yourself. If you're all the time speaking critical thoughts, and critical thoughts are negative thoughts, and negative thoughts are angry thoughts. They're angry thoughts. It's very simple. Negative words are angry thoughts expressed. That's all. Criticizing other people is anger. We might think it's anger because we're not shouting and yelling, but anger is this one of aversion. You either have attachment to something which makes it look gorgeous and you want to be near it, or you have aversion for something or somebody and you want to go away from it. That's bare bones anger. We often wouldn't think it's anger. We only think anger is the volatile shouting. No, it starts with the aversion thought. And then negative speech is an expression. It's angry speech. It mightn't be shouting and yelling. That's harsh words. The four ones of speech are harsh words when you really shout and yell. That harms others, obviously, not to mention harming yourself. There's talking bad things behind backs, which is harsh, which is negative words. It could be harsh, but it's the one that creates disharmony. The person doesn't hear it, but eventually it splits, you know. And it's from anger. Definitely from anger. You lie, say things that aren't right. That's from attachment mostly, and a mistaken sense of self and fear of what people think of you and all this rubbish. Or wanting to build yourself up. Lying is quite an interesting one. And then there's the other one. Just blur. Out the mouth. No control. It's not negative. It's not positive. It's just blur, you know. So we have uncontrolled speech. And I think part of the reason, certainly in our culture, is because we don't have any methods of observing our thoughts and knowing that they are themselves who I am, and that as long as I know them, that's the main thing. But we don't think we have any value until our words come out the mouth. Therefore, we're desperate for other people to hear our thoughts. We don't think they're valuable until they come out my mouth. Then we have this impulse, this compulsion when we're around people to talk. And because we're not aware of our mind, God knows what comes out the mouth, you know. So this sounds so minor, such a small practice. It doesn't sound like spiritual practice. But it's powerful. If in one day you can make a decision never to say harsh words, never to say one bad word behind backs about anybody, this is stunning, actually, that one. Not to rabbit on about nothing, just uncontrolled, and not to say things that aren't true. I mean, right there, you become more peaceful. In the beginning, it doesn't feel like peace because it feels like you're suppressing it. And it is called suppressing. Fantastic suppression. I hope you do suppress your words when you're around other people. I mean, we know there's nothing worse than a person abusing us and harming us and talking about us behind their backs and rabbiting on. So we really wish they would suppress their speech. But suppressing the thoughts, no. Suppressing means denying. And that's the only option we tend to have. We either have vomit it all out or live in denial. That's our two options, you know, and both are tragic. At least if you're one of the ones who does suppress your speech, at least you're not harming others. How fantastic. That's a bonus. So control our body and speech, but don't suppress. Meaning don't suppress the thoughts. We have to become familiar with the thoughts because I am the boss and I have to try and work out what I want in my mind. And that's where we have to real awareness. So we'll only have that real awareness when we can calm down the behavior. Or if we are a quiet person who doesn't express what we think, we have to learn to be brave to confront what we think and not live in denial of it, you know. Not pretend we're not thinking it. Not push it away. So either way, it's tough. Needs hard work. So first level of practice, control your body and speech. Then you've got the space now to look at your mind. That's the real job of being a Buddhist. That's being your own therapist, as Lama Yeshe would put it, you know. And then, more advanced practice, now you can actually help others, benefit others. The first level of practice is sort of like, sounds like passive. Don't harm others. Back off. Leave them alone. Watch your body, watch your speech, watch like a hawk. Don't harm others. This is the first level of the practice of morality. They call it the practice of the morality of restraint. Restrain from harming others. Already fantastic. You, though, are the main beneficiary of this. Definitely others will be the beneficiary. As Lama Zopa puts it, all the rats and roaches will have a party. Because you left them in peace. They'll be happy. Actually, I remember this. I remember reading about some place in Montana somewhere, where all the where some deer were. There was this one place in the shooting season, there's some area, private piece of land where they don't let deer be shot. The deer knew this, and they'd all come there in the shooting season because they knew where they wouldn't get shot. Isn't that interesting? That's amazing, isn't it? The deer knew where they'd be safe, so they came to that non-shooting area. Very sensible. That threw me. Why did I say that? Now I forgot what I said before. I'm so sorry. Yeah, restraining from harming, the first level, which sounds kind of passive, merely don't kill, don't lie, but already we can see it's stupendous for the others. They can appreciate you. And for yourself. The real one is for yourself. You're calming your own crazy energy down. Now you can begin the work of really unraveling your mind, you know, and being your own therapist. Then you can afford to actually do beneficial things to other people. Actually be beneficial. And that's where you practice love and compassion. So sort of one step at a time. And it's very structured in the Buddhist teachings, you know. 11:30 already. Yeah. Don't be ridiculous. We just started.
I know, it goes fast.
But we're only 45 minutes. Well, they'll just have to keep practicing for a few minutes. See if they can keep practicing. So we better have questions then. I'm so sorry. I just began. Forgive me. I was late, I think. So any questions? Any questions? Yes. Go. Microphone here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hope this isn't too silly, but...
Be silly. It's all right.
All right. So if you have the mouse in the house...
Yeah.
You know, you have other options, you know, of, you know, humane trap, getting it
That's
outside,
right.
or
yes.
peppermint oil,
yes.
or whatever. I mean,
sure.
Where does that, I mean, you're still feeling that aversion, right?
Uh-huh.
But you also don't want your house to be overrun
sure.
by
That's right.
mice.
This is, yeah, it's, you know, this is the thing for, it's a big one for us in our culture. We've got to go through several steps beforehand. Because for us, the default mode is it's fine to kill the mouse. And we don't notice that it matters that we have aversion. We think it's a healthy thing. To think mice are disgusting, or to hate the rapist, or to want the terrorist to die. We don't think that's bad at all. We don't realize we're doing harm to our own mind. And it seems quite shocking, first of all, to think that, you know, that being angry harms us. We think that there's kind of anger that's good. We think we're justified. So to even think this one through is quite tough, before we even get to the point of dealing with the mouse. To try to, can you get that point clearly, how anger can harm you? Can you see that? So being, you know, but, so, and how, if you, you know, like, there are awful people on this earth. There are terrorists who kill people. There are mice that do, you know, do their yucky in your spoon drawer. It's true. There are sentient beings who do what we don't like. It's true. There are. But can you see, first of all, how anger towards them can harm you? That's clear to you, is it?
Yes.
Okay, so therefore we can see there is an advantage in not being angry. So that means we then have to see, this doesn't mean you just sit back and go, don't care, because that's what we tend to think. Oh, well, I don't care about terrorists. I can't think that. We either think you don't care or you have anger. So the other option is you realize you don't want to be angry because you don't want to pollute your own mind. And therefore you realize also you don't want to kill the mouse because that's even increasing the negativity that you're planting in your own mind, right? So then that means that, okay, and the same with the terrorists, I don't want to go out there and kill them all, but I don't want to be angry with them. So that means I want to see the truth. I want to see they are harmful. This is awful. They are harmful. The mouse is making dirty in my drawer. So then as Martin Luther King said one time, it's good to see things as wrong. You've got to see the mouse is making dirty in your drawer. You've got to see terrorists are harming people, which is the truth, isn't it? But then you go, what will I do about it? And that's where the practical starts comes in. So you don't have to be angry, but you go, oh my God, that's shocking. Oh my God, look at all that caca in my drawer. Now you've got to be practical. And not having the wish to be angry, not having the wish to harm the terrorist or harm the mouse, you now see, what can I do to help? What can I do to solve the problem? So that already is the stopping of aversion. Because you don't want caca in your spoon drawer, doesn't mean that's aversion. That just means being reasonable to know you don't want to have people get sick or something. You understand my point? And you don't have to hate the terrorists in order to do something to help them. You can put them in prison. You can do, there's all sorts of things. So this is a tricky one, to really be clear that the disadvantage of anger in our own mind and how we can have not have anger but still have intelligence and do something useful to change. It just takes more effort. So I think because we're so intelligent in our culture, as soon as we make a decision, which is what a Buddhist would try to do, I don't want to kill, then you've got to come up with 72 different methods because we're very intelligent. And there are lots of ways we, I think, have a prevent the mice from coming and find a way to get rid of the mouse without killing it, without having following anger through and wanting to destroy the mouse. There's other ways of doing things. Do you see? Which is a tough one. Sometimes we can't see any way out of it, you know. But the one is, again, the key point here to really get the Buddhist view, and we have to look at it, is to see that whatever arises in my mind, that is what produces the experiences, that's what programs me. So then for my sake, I wouldn't want to be angry with a mouse, that's the point. For my sake, I couldn't bear the thought of killing a mouse. This is the point. Then, of course, I can afford to have compassion for the mouse eventually. And that means I want to protect myself from creating negative karma. This is the way Buddhists would say it. Therefore, I'm going to find a solution to this that will be benign as well as possible, that won't harm the sentient beings. And sometimes you can't win. Well, just by existing, we're harming others, aren't we? Just by existing, we're killing creatures all the time. So the main point in the Buddhist one is to start from the point of wishing not to harm. To have this as our basis. To try to do non-harmful things to others. It's tricky. We can't guarantee it won't work. It'll work. But that's the wish, you know, that's the thought, to motivate. Do you understand?
Hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
What is the attachment in killing for food? And what is the action in self-defense that you should take?
Okay, I understand. So, what do you mean, what is the attachment? It is attachment, isn't it? Kill for food is attachment, isn't it? So, you mean, what's the negativity in that? Is that what you're asking? What's more the question? Why is that wrong, you're saying?
Yes. I mean, it's not for, I don't think it's aversion.
It's not aversion, no, no way. A fisherman don't have aversion, they even like fish. It's not being rude about fishermen, just looking at actions, you know. It's attachment. And attachment means, attachment is an energy of what, of getting what I want at the expense of others. A person who's, you know, a person who, I mean, okay, I'll give an example. A friend of mine who had a boy, a son who was a fisherman, a lovely man. But, you know, of course, fishing is not seen as negative in our culture. If it was killing poodles, he'd be seen as a monster, right? Because we're very attached to poodles and not fish. You get my point? Okay, but in his case, he was attached to eating, for killing fish, right? So, all his life, he went fishing, and she was very pained, the mother was pained by this, because she didn't like killing. She never criticized her boy, but this is the point I'm getting at. She went fishing one time with her son, because he always asked her to go. And she found it unbearable, because all she saw was all these fish suffering terribly. It was very clear to her, they weren't happy in that boat. They wanted to be in the water, please. But they can't shout. They don't have voices. They have no little legs and arms, so they can't get out. All they can do is wriggle their little bodies. It's about the best they can do, isn't it? Now, this is the point. She could see immediately by that body language that they weren't happy and they'd rather be in the water, and she had compassion for them. Why? It's because she didn't have attachment to killing. So, her boy, who had enormous attachment, and this is the Buddha's view about karma, and there's more stuff to say here, and we can't go on. But we've got these tendencies very deep in our mind. And then he, from the moment he saw fishing, it looked delicious to him. He was attracted to it. It gave him good feelings. So, of course, you want to keep doing the thing that gives you good feelings, isn't it? Do you see my point? Because we all want to be happy. So this is the point about attachment. For him, because it was a thing he liked to do, which made it look nice to him, he was blind to the compassion. He couldn't see the suffering of the fish. He was completely blind. He couldn't see it. Are you seeing my point? So it doesn't seem like a negative action at all. He's feeling happy. He's having a wonderful time in his boat and the air and the sea and the sun. It looks so natural and wonderful. Meanwhile, these sentient beings in his boat suffering unbearably, actually. But he was a kind man, but he was as completely as blind as a bat because he had attachment to get what he wanted, which blinds you from seeing the harm you do to others. So it's almost, it's not so violent as anger, but it's heavy duty for that mind because you don't see other people's needs. You see what I'm saying? So he got what he wanted at the expense of all these sentient beings. That's how it harms you because he's harming himself.
And
do you see my point?
Yes, I do. And about your action, self-defense.
Okay, so self-defense means, give me a scenario.
You're attacked in an alleyway and someone wants to murder you.
And what do you...
Do you fight back? Do you not?
Okay, fight back meaning?
Them.
Fight back meaning?
Trying to get away, doing what you have to.
Trying to get away? What's wrong with trying to get away from a person who's killing you?
Why is that anything, negative? But you probably have to hurt them in order to do that.
Well, good luck to you if a person's in a dark alley. I bet there's a boy, and I bet he's bigger than you, so good luck to you, girl.
Right. No, I yeah.
So start. Absolutely. Okay, so the point is, the Buddhist view of what karma is, you've got to analyze what's in your mind. So what's in your mind?
Safety, get away.
No, it's not. It's fear.
Hmm.
Primordial, hysterical fear. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Mostly.
Yes.
Unless you're a trained person who doesn't have fear, in which case you could, who knows, do what, you know? So fear's in your mind. And fear is a completely instinctive response of ego, the Buddha would say. It's just natural. So there's fear, and therefore from fear would also come rage and anger and harming, wouldn't it? Would you agree with that? Well, that's negative. You're harming yourself. Completely harming yourself by doing that. I know it sounds so peculiar, because we don't think there's an option. I'm going to keep going, but can you see what I'm saying so far? Which sounds outrageous to say you shouldn't have fear. Most of us will have fear. And then most of us will just panic and have an attack. And then, you know, and then most likely, you won't escape unless he doesn't have a knife. And maybe he will. Or you reason with him. He might be reasonable. Who knows? But that's unlikely. Depends on the person. So, of course, there's nothing wrong with trying to save yourself. Of course there's not. But everything to do with your motivation, sweetheart. Your motivation. So if you can do something to stop the person... That might mean harming him, but if your motivation, and this is really advanced, mm-hmm. we've got to practice this, this is the beginning, this is what martial arts was. Martial arts was the 8th century, the Chinese Buddhist monks up in the mountains, the meditators, they were the ones who began karate and martial arts, you know, kung fu, whatever they called it. And the whole motivation was to use your body, use these skills of fighting, to prevent the person, for their sake, from harming you. That's really noble, isn't it? So there was no thought of wishing to harm. No thought at all. And even when I learned Kung Fu, I had a really good teacher, a Buddhist teacher. That was what we were taught. So it's not to do with violence. It's not to do with harming others. So, you know, if you're a mother and you shout at your child and you know it's for their sake because they weren't listening, that's called tough love, right? What's your motivation? Complete compassion, isn't it? So the action isn't necessarily the thing that makes it bad. It's what's in the mind. So if you sit there freaking out, have anger and rage, and you're, let's say, you smash the person to pieces because you're so full of anger, honey, I don't care if it's called self-defense. You just created heavy negative karma. But to save yourself isn't negative. It's reasonable if you can do it without wanting to harm. But most of us aren't trained this way. We just fall into the pattern of habit and anger and fear, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
So it's what goes on in your mind that determines the karma you create.
Thank you.
Do you understand? Are they all waiting? They're going to have to wait, aren't they?
Yes.
For a couple of minutes. We're not finished. We're nearly finished here. But just because they're little doesn't mean they're more important than big people. We get all sentimental about little people. Excuse me. We were little people once. Now big people are just as important. Although you're all going crazy, are they?
Yes.
Well, they just have to practice patience, tell them. Go and tell them. Tell them, be 5 more minutes, okay? Go and have fun. 5 minutes. Then we finish nicely here. Okay. Yes, people. Yes. Come, please, come. Well, bring him in and we can all have a... Listen, Sarah, why can't they come and sit down or they get too excited? Okay, let them hang out for a bit longer. It doesn't matter. Yes.
So when you talk about merit,
yes.
there's nobody keeping score.
Nobody, only you.
Nobody at all.
No, just you. You. When you're practicing the piano... Using these two terms of purifying and creating merit, every time you play the right notes, that's called creating merit. You with me? And every time you stop playing the wrong notes, you're purifying, aren't you? You're changing your habits, right? Well, then you're keeping score because you can see the result, can't you? Well, same here, baby. Same here. You can see the result because you're going to get a better, wiser, nicer, kinder person. You can see the results of your practice. If you don't, it sometimes gets more difficult. Sometimes you even think you're getting worse because you're going more deep in. But if you don't see the results, then you're clearly not doing it properly, honey. If you practice piano for 10 years and still can't play, something is obviously missing. So if you're practicing morality every day and not killing and not lying and not stealing and struggling to stop being angry and you see no results, well, I'd suggest you're not doing it right. You are keeping score, just like you are. You've got a teacher who encourages you, but finally you're the one who gets the result. My mother used to say it, my Catholic mum, virtue has its own rewards. It brings the person, it causes you, it turns you into the person you want to become. It's not holy, it's practical. Do you see? Then others will see the benefit. That's the bonus. It's a very good question. Who else before we let the little ones in? Any burning questions of any kind? In case, just in case you have. No? You're content. Not content. Happy campers. Okay. Then we just do our little, finish our little trip here together. I'm just thinking. I don't know, it was only 45 minutes or 50 minutes, whatever it was. As many thoughts as every one of us has had, the Buddha would say, is sown a seed in the mind. So we'd be delighted, this 50 minutes. Be delighted. Be encouraged. Be inspired to never give up controlling our body and speech for our sake and controlling our mind, and then genuinely for the sake of others, one step at a time, that we can do it. It is natural. It is possible. It is doable. And it's up to us to do it. So rejoice in our progress. Delight. Delight and keep track. Keep, what did you just say? What was the word you used? Keep score. Good one. Thank you very much. I like that. You keep score. That means at the end of the day, you check all the good things you did. Don't just remember the bad things. Go, I did a good job today. Just like my friend in prison who, when he put his friend's head down the toilet, he told me, Rabina, I took it out again. I rejoice that he just didn't kill a fourth person. Well done, Richie. That's progress. That's practice. Okay? So when you didn't nearly murder your husband yet again, you go to bed with a happy mind that you did control yourself. Well done. Or if you're into having, you know, if you're attached to cute girls and you're just craving cute girls the whole time, even though it's painful, every time you don't jump on another girl, especially if she's not your wife, you just purify it. Be happy with this. So we've got to live with this rubbish inside us sometimes and know it won't make us crazy and it doesn't determine who we are, that we identify with our potential. When you're only a grade one with piano, you identify with being grade 12 person. That causes you to keep going. Same here. And be happy. And never give up. Okay. Okay, good. Bring the little ones in to entertain us big ones. You might have to stand up to see you people. They're all up at the front here. Come on, you guys.
Sorry for the noise. My name's Erin, and I'm the coordinator for the Children and Youth Program. There are like over 20 volunteers that make this program happen. We're all working with our minds with the hope that we can benefit the students in the program, and that makes our teachers very important. We are very grateful for the kindness that Venerable Rabina has shown by spending so much time with us. I think the parents are probably grateful for your teachings that are so clear and direct. And maybe the kids will even be grateful if their parents end up being a little bit better parents. When we do programs in the Gampa, a lot of it is just a celebration of the good times that we have in the children's program. But we also understand that a way to show our gratitude toward our teachers is to show our efforts for increasing our knowledge. So we'd like to offer these presentations with that in mind. If anyone doesn't know anything about the program, we explore 16 guidelines along with Buddhist ideas. They're based on character traits from a 7th century Tibetan king and developed within the Foundation for Developing Wisdom and Compassion. Lama Zopa Rinpoche explains that we need to teach children these qualities so that children have to create karma because children have to create karma from their own side in order to experience happiness and success. Currently, we're studying how we relate to others. So that includes respect, forgiveness, gratitude, responsibility. You'll hear a lot of gratitude because that was most recent. And so in this wisdom group, we are talking about cherishing others, understanding independence, and equanimity. Big thing.
Okay, great.
All right,
brilliant.
So our first group is the middle school group, and they're going to talk for themselves.
Come on in. If you have to stand up, if you want to stand up at the back so you can see what's going on if you need to.
Who gets the mic?
I'm going to put you right here. You guys.
All right, everybody. We're presenting the Tower of Gratitude to you all. We've been working on this for the past 3 weeks. We basically took a bunch of boxes and stacked them on top of each other and covered them with paper and things that all of us are grateful for. We have, we've taken quotes from, they're very famous quotes. We have pictures of different animals and wildlife. We have some of the 8 auspicious symbols on here. Just different all things that we're thankful and grateful for. Put a lot of work into this and getting it to stick together to bring in here. I believe we're going to, after this is dismissed, the tower is going to be outside by the front for everyone to look at if you want to.
I want to quote what Walt Disney says down here. I love this. The more people you, the more you like yourself, the less you are like anyone else, which makes you unique. That's Walt Disney. Well done, Mr. Disney. Go on then.
Yes. I think that that's about it, though.
Well, we should read more. There's another one. So this is from Thornton Wilder. We can only be said to be alive in these moments when our hearts are conscious of our treasures. Mr. Thornton Wilder. Thank you very much. You've made great choices, you guys. Let us be grateful to people who make us happy. They are the charming gardeners who make our souls blossom. That's Marcel Proust. How's that? How was he called? Proust. I thought it would have been Proust. Then Mr. William James said, the deepest craving of human nature is the need to be appreciated. Well, Buddha would call that attachment to reputation. But I think that's a good side. That's the good side of it. Be appreciated. It's true. He's really on the case, Mr. James. Wow, good. How amazing. I want to read them. I have to come out. I have to come out and read them. Let's go. Okay. Be thankful for what you have. You'll end up having more. If you concentrate on what you don't have, you will never have enough. That's Miss Oprah Winfrey. It was very great. I like these. And Mr. Disney again. All of our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. That's called enthusiastic perseverance. Never give up. And I think that's all. There we go. That's amazing. Oh, more. Where, darling?
Right there and there.
Okay. Okay. As we express our gratitude, we must never forget that the highest appreciation is not to utter words, but to live by them. Mr. John F. Kennedy. Being a hero doesn't mean you're invincible. It means you're brave enough to stand up for what's needed. That's pretty good. Piper McLean. Who's that? Huh? Oh, okay. Good, darling. Wonderful. A person is a person no matter how small. Dr. Seuss. What, any more? I missed some?
I believe that's it.
Wow, amazing, you guys. Love it. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so once again, this will be on a table out front once everyone is dismissed if you want to take a look at it. And I believe that's it, so thank you.
I want a picture of me and these people. Can we have a picture?
Yes, a picture. First.
Come on, you guys. Come on.
You can take the picture.
Where would you like?
Anyway, you just do it. We've got, make sure the tower's showing. And show the tower.
Right.
Come on, you guys. Here we go. Are we all in?
Yeah, no,
no, go to squeeze up. Bit fat, not long. Squeeze up, darling. Come on. There we go. And the tower's in too.
All right.
All right,
we've got one
shot.
I'll save it.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Ellen.
Squeeze in, because there's a lot more kids. So find your families or squeeze to the back, please. And go ahead and let. Our next class that's coming in is the second through fourth grade class, 7, 8, 9, 10. Welcome Kara and her class. I stole a few of her kids today to help me in my class. Kara, come on in.
You can face everyone in the Gampa. We would love to face Rubina, but then everybody can't see.
I know, but no one can see them. They're sitting down at all. They have to sit, do they?
Yes, come. Come sit this way. Take over.
You're going to have to stand up to see them then.
Just like we did in the class.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Kara. I'm one of the teachers in the children's program, and I'm the teacher this year for the second through fourth graders who have actually been teaching since they were in the preschool program.
Wow.
So I know some of these children very, very well. Kaya is one of our students this year, and she would like to explain to you what we've been doing the past couple of weeks.
We've been learning about the people in the world and how we treat them, and then we made wishes for those people.
And then what, darling? Come here. Then what?
And then we made wishes for those people.
Wow, wonderful.
So we're going to do a little example of some of the wishes that we've been talking about.
Good.
I wish for peace.
Can't
she wishes for peace.
No, let her say it, darling. Let her say it. More clearly, sweetheart. We want to hear. We're dying to hear you, darling.
Yes.
Say it beautifully.
I wish for peace.
Good.
I wish for peace and love.
Good, darling.
I wish for food and water.
Good.
I wish for a safe and healthy life.
She said a safe and healthy life.
Sweetheart, tell him to go, help her to use the mic. Go closer.
Hold it close to your mouth.
Right close. Treat it like an ice cream. Right close to your mouth. As you're about to lick it, then you speak. Stand up. Close to your mouth.
I wish for everybody. Wait. I wish for warm and safe homes.
Good, darling.
I wish for happiness.
Good.
I wish for joy. Okay. I wish for everybody to be healthy, I think. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Well.
I wish to grow up safely.
Good, darling. What about this one? He hasn't said anything. Try him.
Try again.
Come on, darling. Sweetheart, I want to hear what your wishes are.
No. So some of them are going to choose to keep them in their mind.
Good, darling.
Today.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Good. May your wishes come true.
Yeah.
Sweetheart.
And these wishes are for...
For myself! Wait a minute.
And what else?
For friends and family.
Good, darling.
Mm-hmm. For neighbors and communities. For enemies.
Well done.
Yeah, and now. And? Very good.
David, take a picture. Okay, stay there. David, take a picture while you're there. We've got a picture for all of us? Okay. There we go. Thanks. Good, you guys. Thank you so much.
Please try to squish back or find your family.
Thank you, darlings. Thank you. Thank you, sweetheart. See you later.
That way.
Bye. Thanks.
All right. Come on in, my next group. Come on in. Sit right here. Sit right here, facing that way, like you would at the very beginning. Good job. Good job. Thank you, Paul and Kai. You can stand right here.
Sit here, darling.
And everybody
sit
else,
kind
of. Yeah, Layla, you can stand.
There you go. Stand you sit here. Sit here, sweetheart.
Go over there. Go sit over there.
All right.
Oh, Estad, are you okay? Hey, Alyssa, can you go sit? Can we go keep walking? There we go. All right. So this is a lot of kindergarten and first graders, and I also borrowed a few older kids to help me today. One of our favorite times in class is snack, and we have a special prayer that we say before snack. And today we did a little exercise. We do this quite often about how we got our food. So this is a picture of a chocolate chip cookie in the middle. And all the beings, well, some of the beings, can you look at
come over here, you too. Come over here. Stand up here and show the people. Stand up here. That's it. And lift it up high and show everybody. Lift it up right high. That's it. Look, see?
So that's
a cookie in the middle with all the different people who work on it.
All right.
Well done,
so,
darling.
So Victoria is going to tell us some of the people that helped make this cookie.
The farmers and the people who would put the stuff on the shelf. So then the people would come to the store, and they would buy the stuff, and then they'd eat it. Because why we need food is because we need energy to run, to walk, to play. And if we didn't have any food, then we wouldn't be alive.
So I see some animals and all kinds of things on there. Victoria, would you say that's every being that helped make that cookie?
Not every single one.
Would you say that it goes on forever and ever, that every one of those beings on there is dependent on many, many countless other beings?
Yes.
Okay, great. We also, since we had a special treat, wanted to share a treat. And so Layla is going to hand something to Venerable Rabina. And then she's going to later make her way around
Thank
with
you,
a
darling.
Special
Thank
treat
you
for everybody in the
Thank
Gampa.
You,
she's got a little kiss for everybody. Before we brought this food in here, we said a prayer about this food that all the kids are going to say. And then we're going to say Om Ahum at the end three times to remove any impurities that happened in this whole process and transform it to nectar and offer it to the Buddhas. So Rachel's going to show our sign to the kids, and it's not big enough for everybody. But the kids, can you ready? One. We're going to say our prayer. Thank you, all living beings, for giving us this food. May it nourish us so that we may nourish others. Om Ahum. Om Ahum. Om Ahum. All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So tune in, and you can hand those out whenever you want. Last class is our preschool class. So you guys go find a place to sit over there if you can.
Thank you, darlings. Thank you. Thank you.
Can I keep walking? Here, I'll take that one. So you don't have to stay attached to each other. Yeah, go ahead. Just right in front. We have our preschool class. You can face sideways. The preschool class is going to sing a song to the tune of If You're Happy and You Know It. So I expect everyone in the Gampa can pick up this song and start singing. Do you want? I am a horrible singer, but anyone have a grateful
and you know it, say I am. I am. If you're grateful and you know it, say I am. I am.
If you're grateful,
then your smile will surely show it.
If you're grateful and you know it, say I am.
I am.
Grateful and you know it, clap your hands. If you're grateful and you know it, clap your hands. If you're grateful and you know it, then your smile will surely show it. If you're grateful and you know it, say amen. If you're grateful and you know it, stomp your feet. If you're grateful and you know it, stomp your feet. If you're grateful and you know it, then your smile will surely show it. If you're grateful and you know it, say I am.
Grateful and you know it, you are free. I am. Grateful and you know it.
you. Where's the mic?
Okay, so.
Okay.
Thank you so much to the children's program for doing such an amazing job organizing that. So to wrap up the program, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a mandala of thanks offering. And for all of you who want to participate, what you can do is imagine offering to the teacher and the Buddhas all of your toys and food and beautiful clothes and shopping malls and everything in the whole universe. You offer that up as a gift. And so that's what you can do while we're saying the verses and presenting this tray of offerings. And then as Venerable Khando reads the dedications and prayer list, anyone who'd like to come up and offer katas will be invited to do so. And then we are going to have a group photo out at the stupa. So anybody who'd like to participate, please quickly get your shoes and go on out to the stupa. David, our kind photographer, will be organizing that.
I want all of you in the picture.
So everyone,
why can't we just do a group? Why can't we just do it here? It doesn't work.
Just won't fit.
Okay, we won't fit around there either.
Yeah, we will. David has it well organized. Yeah.
Okay. So someone will make it happen.
Yes.
Just walk out to the stupa. Take 5 minutes. Won't be long. Okay.
Okay.
Let's go. You going to do a short one? Long one. Short one. Short. Okay. Saji perki shushing metod chamri rabling ji ni de gyan pa ji sangge jing du mik te ul wa gi dro kun nam da jing la cha pa shok Dagi chak dan mong sun kebe Yul dan yen bar sum lu dang long che che Pang pa me pa bu gi leg jene Dug som rang sa drol wa jin gi lo Bidam guru ratna mandala kam niryataya mi Excelling.
Well, if Jill Marie and Karen Edwards,
move my cup out of the way, would you? Move all these other
things. How fortunate we all are to have the opportunity and the karma to hear precious teachings from our precious teachers. May our hearts and minds transform so we may be truly beneficial for the future enlightenment of all sentient beings. Linda and Royden Sadden for the long lives of our precious teachers and the benefit of all sentient beings. Lynn Ingram, this offering is made with the prayer that all sentient beings discover the Dharma and recognize that through dedicated personal practice there can be freedom from the imprisonment and suffering of all mental delusions. Paul Hagwood, Karen Mastriani, and David Maclis. May all beings everywhere plagued by sufferings of body and mind obtain a notion of happiness by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or bewildered with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from all their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be free. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remained, until then may I too remain to dispel the misery of the world. I'm going to say the long life prayers for our precious teachers. In the land encircled by the snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara's end. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion. To the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. Ramazopa Rinpoche, you who hold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of oral, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjuna's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplishes magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Long life prayer for Ken Rinpoche, Jetson Lobson Delek, the one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Awatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void. Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara's end. Long life prayer for Venerable Rabina, mother of victorious ones of the three times and ten directions, Dharmakaya, the great bliss enhanced by great compassion, my perfect Aryatara, who in an ordinary form are the guide for us pitiful transmigratory beings left godless, how kind you are. May all your wishes be instantly fulfilled, and may your life be stable until samsara ends. Almighty One, you who destroy all the enemy of delusions, who reveal the Dharma of Scripture and realization, spreading it in the mental continuum of transmigrating beings, thereby eliminating the two obscurations, including their imprints, how kind you are. May all your wishes be instantly fulfilled, and may your life be stable until samsara ends. By the blessings of the Guru, the Deity, and the Dharma protectors, and unbetraying actions and the results, as well as the truth of ultimate reality, in all my lifetimes may I only please and never displease for even 1 second the Guru, and may all the vital points of my prayers be fulfilled. And Tara mantras for the long, healthy life of Geshe Gelug. Om Tari Tu Tari Ture Soha. 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 Om Tari Tu Tari Ture Soha.